From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. President-elect Donald Trump made more cabinet appointments, choosing another retired general to head the Homeland Security Department and an ally of the oil and gas industry to run the Environmental Protection Agency. Trump engaged in new Twitter wars with the head of Boeing Corporation and a union leader and defended a controversial phone call with the president of Taiwan that roiled U.S. relations with China. U.S. life expectancy declined for the first time since 1993, with rises in the death rate from non-communicable diseases, especially heart disease. Tom, let's start with the latest Trump picks. What's the old line about the fox guarding the hen house or the arsonist and so on? Some interesting picks here for EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. We have the Oklahoma Attorney General, Scott Pruitt. What can you tell us about Scott Pruitt?
Well, he is an ardent foe of the Environmental Protection Agency that he has now been nominated to serve and to run. He says the science on global warming is far from settled. He is, I don't think it's too strong to say that he's a climate change denier. And it's somewhat inexplicable because during the transition, President-elect Trump has tried to appear to be moving to the middle, especially on some of his appointments. Yes, he has named several hardline appointments, but others he's tried to strike a more moderate tone. But this particular appointment, there's no middle ground. This guy has strong convictions. He thinks the government should get out of clean air and clean water. I shouldn't say that. He says he's committed to clean air and clean water, but he does not want the federal government to be in charge of that. He's talked constantly about federal overreach on the question of environmental control. I think he's a big fan of oil and gas. I read the other day that about 10% of the country's gas or oil, one or the other, is from Oklahoma. And so this will be interesting to see how he fares. He'll be inheriting a bureaucracy, I suspect, that will be ever anxious to leak on him when he starts doing some things.
Well,
so that's not a good prescription, but it certainly does. In fairness, it fits President-elect Trump's vow to shake up the system. It certainly does at EPA.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like a hostile takeover of an agency that he doesn't believe in, Linda. But how much can he actually do? You know, I've been reading a lot about, utilities and whatnot that are planning 20, 30 years ahead,
right,
who are already making a shift from coal, for example. Can he really bring back jobs in coal?
I don't know that he can bring back jobs in coal, in large part because the economics of energy have shifted dramatically in the last few years. So hydraulic fracking has allowed a boom in natural gas, and that has hurt the coal industry, I think, more than anything. But there's this belief among Republicans and in the Trump team that the, quote, excessive regulation of the Obama administration has really hurt fossil fuels and hurt energy in this country.
But we're energy independent. I mean, we don't,
well,
yeah, for the
we
first
are
time.
Because of and, natural gas
yeah.
and oil and all of the above, as Obama keeps saying. So the thing about the EPA is it does a lot by regulation. And that's the kind of thing that can be changed within the system. You don't need Congress. The president, President Trump, can sign orders to change things and issue orders to have his bureaucracy shift things in the direction he wants.
Yeah. Obviously, we will have to see what sort of confirmation fight he's going to face. I would think that Pruitt would be among those who would get particularly tough scrutiny in the Senate, Tom. Mm-hmm. And another one is the choice for Labor Secretary Andrew Puzder, who is a fast food king, runs a couple of the chains, Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, that produce fast food burgers and whatnot. And this gentleman has quite the record for somebody who's been named to Secretary of Labor. Apparently, his own outfits have been challenged. 60% of the investigations at Carl's Jr. and Hardee's resulted in labor law violations. He also opposes an increase in the federal minimum wage, which is currently set at only $7.25 an hour. What are we to make of this choice, and how will Trump's supporters in the working class look at this?
I think this is going to be a problem for the new president with people, with working class voters who you can argue are responsible for him becoming president in places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, so-called Reagan Democrats, who clearly are not traditional Republicans, but who were appealed to by Reagan and who appealed to and liked the whole notion of what Trump was proposing. They can't be happy about this. It's clearly Trump is not a big labor person, and his new Secretary of Labor is not a big working class person either. But and so I think this will be a problem. I think this is also going to be a nomination confirmation process that is going to be very, very messy and bloody. It will be interesting. The Democrats are going to have to pick their choices.
They cannot
blindly oppose everybody, but they've got to pick a couple. They might pick this one, and they might pick EPA. I don't think there'll be a problem with getting General James Mattis confirmed as Secretary of Defense. Maybe Senator Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. That will be interesting. But appointments like these two we're talking here have tarnished the luster a little bit of the whole notion that Donald Trump is going to move to the middle and govern from the middle. I think he's still going to govern center right and maybe center a little further right than some had suspected. We'll see.
His daughter, Ivanka, took Al Gore to a meeting with her father. Obviously, that didn't do very much good, did it, in terms of the choice of the EPA person.
No, the parade of interesting characters who go in and out of the lobby of Trump Tower presents one picture of how he's conducting his transition, meeting with Democrats and out-and-out liberals and getting their points of view. And these people like Al Gore come out of these meetings seemingly enthusiastic and saying, we had a really interesting conversation, it will continue. And then Donald Trump goes and appoints these ultra-conservative, very wealthy, in a lot of cases, cabinet secretaries. In fact, the other day, he's giving this thank you tour to the battleground states, and he said, I like people who have made a fortune. So he's putting billionaires and millionaires and just overall wealthy people onto his cabinet, which you do wonder what the working class white voters who elected him are thinking of that. And maybe they're not paying attention. I suspect for those voters, the proof will be in their pocketbooks,
sure,
or in their sense of optimism about the future. I'm not sure they really care about who Trump puts in his cabinet, as long as they can see light at the end of the tunnel and see an improvement in their lives.
I just wanted to add that Mr. Pusseter is chairman of a company founded by Carl Karcher, a legendary California fast food businessman. And it's not just that they do fast food, Hardee's and Carl's Jr., but they pride themselves on these enormous burger sandwiches, the mega burger, the triple burger. There are a couple of them that, you know, one hamburger is over 2,500 calories, which is basically what the average person needs for an entire day. So you can be sure that the Democrats are going to be asking questions like that
at least he didn't name him head of Health and Human Services, so
right.
I suppose we have something to be grateful for there. The other pattern, Tom, besides very wealthy people and people who oppose the agencies that they're supposed to run, are the generals, the military theme running through. And the pick for Homeland Security is General John Kelly, another retired four-star Marine.
Right, and he's also, in addition to General Mattis and retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who's going to be his national security advisor. They've flirted with General David Petraeus, but it does not appear that he's going to get a job capable as he is. We have to remember that during the campaign, Donald Trump, in one of his many celebrated utterances, said, I know more about ISIS than the generals.
Right.
I think now that he's getting in briefings, he knows that that's not true. And he seems to be a little awestruck by generals. Now, I must say, in fairness, that when I went into the Army in 1968, I dealt with a few generals as a second lieutenant and a first lieutenant, and they did not seem to me to be Renaissance men. But the military has changed. These days, over the last 20 years, a fast track to becoming a general includes not only a war or two, but command of combat elements, but it also includes MBAs from Harvard or from the Tufts or the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts or the Foreign Service. And so I think people who don't know much about the military would be very surprised, and I think pleasantly surprised, at the number of advanced degrees that senior military officials have. There's still a somewhat rigid culture, of which I spent 22 years, I should tell our listeners. But I think Trump has been awestruck, as I said, by some of these generals, and so I don't worry about that. I'd worry if he did two or three more generals, because however talented they are, there is a certain cultural mindset in the military, and it's always good at senior levels of the government to have a more of a diverse spectrum of views, both on society and culture and military and foreign policy and all that kind of stuff. So we'll have to see, but it is an interesting phenomenon. It's very clear that there'll be more generals in the higher echelons of this administration than in any other I can remember.
Yeah, Linda, do you have a thought about the march of the generals into the Trump administration?
I think it's, certainly the people involved have stellar qualifications. Mike Flynn, as National Security Advisor, of course, raises a lot of red flags with his tweets, which I guess he's stopped tweeting. It's possible we could wind up with five generals or admirals in top positions. I mean, David Petraeus, who has a PhD, I would add, not only is under consideration for State Department, he's also under consideration for Director of National Intelligence. And then there's James Stavridis, an admiral who's under consideration for State Department. So I think even if each of these gentlemen is highly qualified, intelligent, sophisticated for the most part, just the optics of having so many military men. And we know, I think this says a lot about Donald Trump. We know he went to military school for high school, but he never served in the military. And I think he has this kind of dreamy admiration of these guys. They're tough, they're macho, he's everything that he wants to be. And I do worry a little bit that that sort of is a tell, that it tells us how Donald Trump plans to behave as president. And we're seeing that already in his treatment of China and other issues.
We're going to get to that in a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor, and joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. This program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Linda, let me come back to you on that, because we have seen, as has been a consistent pattern through the campaign and after the election and now in the transition, the Twitter wars of Donald Trump. He took a telephone call from the president of Taiwan, unprecedented event since 1979 when the United States recognized mainland China as the only China. And then when there were objections raised to it, he lashed out on Twitter at China. He has lashed out also at a union leader who had the temerity to suggest that this deal to save some jobs at a Carrier air conditioning and heating plant, you know, that not so many jobs were actually being saved. How are we to regard this use of this medium, and what are the dangers?
It's really revolutionary in some ways. This is the future president of the United States talking not just to the American people, but to the world, unfiltered, over the heads of the traditional media, saying whatever he wants and being very aggressive and provocative in these statements. We're seeing him pick fights with the world in many ways, not only with the world and with little guys.
Yeah, with everyone from a student or here or there to the leader of a country.
I mean, it just proves the point that was made over and over during the campaign, that he's thin-skinned and that if somebody calls him a name or calls him a liar, he hates that. That he's going to come striking right back at them. And it's, in many ways, unbecoming of a president. It's punching down. I mean, he's going to be president of the United States, and here he's going after this local union official in Indiana who's a very compelling and authentic figure.
Chuck Jones.
Has been a union guy for over 30 years, is protecting the interests of the workers, and they're upset about how the Carrier deal has been portrayed. Yes, some jobs were saved, but not all the jobs that Donald Trump is claiming. And it's certainly a trick that can't, this is not a model for how Donald Trump is going to bring jobs back to the country. So Donald Trump has this habit of taking an incident or an episode and ballooning it up into a several-day story,
yeah.
which is about something that's just really not that important. I mean, we're looking to him for sort of big threads, big analysis of what he's going to be doing, and he's getting into these little sort of fistfights.
Tom, again, how is this going to affect his rapport with the working class? Chuck Jones is the president of United Steelworkers Local 1999. He told the Washington Post that Trump had, quote, lied his ass off when he claimed that he had saved over 1,000 jobs at the Carrier plant. In fact, it's going to be 800 max, and people at the plant say that they're going to put a lot of the money they're going to get from their tax breaks into automation, which will eventually eliminate those jobs.
Right. It's the whole Twitter thing is problematic for several reasons. One is that Trump has had a tendency in the past to pass on in a tweet something that turns out not to be true. And you know, I'm sure there are aides around the president-elect saying, oh my gosh, how can we get him to send his tweets to us first so we can vet them? Well, that's not going to happen. Right, you know, yeah. That's not going to happen. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, he said that the only reason Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by about 3 million votes is because there were millions of people who voted illegally.
That, no proof.
That is not true. I mean, that has been documented to be not true. And so these are the sorts of things that will complicate life for him. It also is a problem with dealing with foreign countries like that. The first reaction to his call from the Taiwanese president was, she called me.
Well, of course, it took months to set
right.
This up.
This was a calculated right. deal. The real question is, what do we know about how offended the Chinese are? I think the Chinese are very offended, but have decided at the moment mm-hmm. to lie low, but you may be sure that at a point of their choosing,
mm-hmm. sure.
the Chinese will retaliate, and it may not make headlines, but everybody's going to know about it.
Yeah, well, Linda, I did a column actually for VOA this week about making China great again.
Hmm.
It's not just the phone call from the Taiwanese president, but a number of things that at least Trump said during the campaign, now we'll see if he carries them out, that really will help make China a leader in the region.
I do want to go back to one thing very quickly, Barbara,
sure.
and there was one good cabinet appointment, or not a cabinet appointment, but Trump is going to nominate the governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad, to be the ambassador to Beijing. And this might be a head-scratcher, except for the fact that he's got a long relationship with the Chinese. He's got a personal relationship with the president of China, who was a young agricultural official who came to Iowa 30 years ago.
Yeah.
They're close. This was a smart move. And so, you know.
Yeah, this actually raises questions about, you know, things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because this was a laboriously negotiated agreement, 12 countries, including the United States, all our major Pacific Rim trading partners except for China.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way to sort of determine the rules of the road for trade, set labor standards, environmental standards. Now, during the campaign, both Trump and Hillary Clinton said that they weren't happy with it. But somebody like Terry Branstad would want this. I mean, this is very advantageous for agricultural exports and so on. So, you know, we don't really know yet, do we, where a lot of these things are going to fall in the actual Trump presidency. But China could become, you know, much more considered, I mean, a leader in trade, a leader in environment, the responsible stakeholder that has been described over the years. You know, they might choose to take that role if we have an erratic president of the United States.
Right. And I think another sort of overarching theme that we're seeing is Trump creating leverage. He's taking the existing status quo and shaking it up and
trying to create leverage.
Right, trying. He's taking his reputation as a wheeler dealer businessman, art of the deal, and taking existing agreements and conventions and saying not so fast.
Right.
He did that with Boeing. One fine day we wake up and he's tweeted that he's going to renegotiate the contract or cancel the order, he said, for a new Air Force One. I think it's two new Air Force Ones,
right,
which are aging. There's more than one Air Force One. Whatever plane the president in is Air Force One. So this is what he did as a businessman, and
right.
this what it looks like he's going to try to do as president.
Yeah, and of course now we hear that Boeing will lower the cost or whatever.
Right, so
for
he's
going to.
So he's. I think he's going to have some
Tom,
success.
Tom, he can't. He can't renegotiate personally through Twitter.
every deal that the United States of America is involved in. So
no, he
he's
can't.
Pick and choose, I suppose, different ones. Yeah?
No, he can't. But it is the art of the deal. Trump sees himself as the premier deal maker on the planet, and he's going to continue to do this. As I said, there's so many levels to the tweet business, and one of them is he's found a way to communicate directly with the American people through these tweets. Every president, and I've now will soon be, have start covering my 10th president.
Wow.
Every one of them has said, I want to go over the heads of the media and reach the American people unfiltered, because the media, you know, every president doesn't like the media. Well, this is a way that Trump has figured out that he can do that more successfully than other presidents. So I think it's also part of his persona, his character. So I see no way for the tweets to stop. It'll be interesting to see whether there's any way to control them and manage them.
Yeah. I did want to talk about a very important domestic story also, aside from the Trump transition, Linda, and that is some very disturbing news that has come out about the life expectancy of Americans. For the first time since 1993, when we were still in the throes of an AIDS crisis, life expectancy has now gone down. You know, the reasons for it, perhaps you can tell us. Let's see, life expectancy was 78.8 years in 2015. That's a decrease of 0.1% from 2014. Overall death rate increased 1.2%. What are the factors?
Well, it's a range of diseases that are killing people. It's behavioral issues. It's drinking. It's drugs. We have an opioid epidemic going on. It's suicide. And this was, I think, one of the undercurrents during the campaign, especially of white working class people seeing no prospects and engaging in behaviors that were detrimental. It's also a problem with people not having adequate health care.
Yes.
And here we are with an incoming president who wants to throw out the current president's health reform, which has added an additional 20 million people to the health rolls. Yes, the numbers have gotten worse. Life expectancy has declined only slightly. I think maybe the story has been overblown a little bit, but I think for a country that sees itself as on a constant forward march of progress, to see even a plateau or a slight decline is disturbing. I mean, the United States is, I think, somewhere in the 40s in the world rankings of countries' life expectancy. But in part, it's, I think, a signal of how diverse the country is. We're not homogeneous, and we have a lot of immigrants.
Yeah, but this is really, Tom, a function of income inequality, isn't it, more than anything? Because if you look at these figures, if you're rich, you live longer. I think there's one statistic in the case of white males, 14 years longer if you're rich.
Right, and if you're not rich, you're going to be eating a lot of those super mega fast food.
Exactly, you're going to be going to our labor secretary's fast food restaurants, right?
The thing that strikes me about all this, Barbara, is the one I can't figure out is heart disease becoming more of a killer. I mean, Linda has laid this out extremely well here, and it's even more ironic because the advances in medical technology are just amazing. And so medical care is getting better, but back to your point, if you can afford that super-duper care, you're probably going to be okay. But the heart disease thing is a problem. I think that part of that is diet. People eating fast food means, by definition, a lot of salt, a lot of oil, a lot of red meat.
Sugar.
And all of that pays a price. But, I mean, I think people's lifestyles, many people's lifestyles, are such that, one, that's all they can afford, and life has become more complicated and more tense. And if you have more divorces, then you have more mixed families to deal with. I just think the tension level for people who are not at the top of the pyramid in terms of income has gotten more difficult, leading to all kind of negative problems.
I would say there's a lot of stress, period, in society, certainly this year. This is,
absolutely.
I think just the personal terms, I don't know that I've ever felt quite so much adrenaline and anxiety as I have in the last few months.
And we're going from Michelle Obama, who's the queen of healthy eating, to Donald Trump, who loves his McDonald's.
Well, so he says he does,
I think he does. We've seen him with the large fries. That's there's a heart attack waiting to happen.
Maybe he should talk to Bill Clinton, who loved those McDonald's Big Macs, and finally his doctor said, you're going to have a problem, and he had a heart problem.
Right. Yeah, and Donald Trump is of that age, but of course he's going to have the very best health care that can be provided, certainly when he moves into the White House. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief of the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor for National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.